Jimmy, how would you describe the scope of the problem as you've seen it? You've done a tremendous amount of research, investigation, traveling the world, and continuing to monitor this compelling issue. How would you describe it at this point?
Well, it's a hard portrait to illustrate, because it's estimated that upwards of 300,000 children around the world are drawn into conflict as soldiers, and that could mean frontline troops, cooks, porters, sex slaves, scouts, and spies. It's also estimated that these children who are participating in the war are located in more than 40 countries. The exact figures are hard to come by because, of course, many of the individuals who use children to fight are non-governmental. They're not state actors, and they're not subject to reliable surveys or exploration of their use of kids. But based on what we know from talking to former child soldiers and based on refugee patterns, we believe upwards of 300,000 children are drawn into war.
And now you mentioned that in some cases this is not these are not government agents who are drawing them in, but insurgent groups as well.
Yeah.
Are some of these child warriors joining up voluntarily?
Sometimes kids do join voluntarily, and we say voluntarily, but often voluntarily is not fully accurate because they're compelled to join for economic reasons, for protection, for everyday survival. So in some situations, girls may enlist as a way of avoiding sexual violence or being prey to rape or other forms of assault. Kids in Colombia, example, whom I've spoken with, have joined because being a part of a military force, even as a child, can give one some authority, albeit artificial. At the same time, they get to wear a uniform, they're part of a larger group, and they get one or two meals a day. And in some situations, that's more than they have in civilian life.
But typically, these kids are compelled to join with one side or the other. And
exactly.
And what we see is so many who are really trained in weaponry, as you write so poignantly. They learn to hold an AK-47 even before they learn to hold a pencil.
That's exactly right. I mean, from strictly, filtering out the morality, the ethics of using kids in war, strictly from a military point of view, it's a very pragmatic thing to do. We know from talking to active and former child soldiers that kids tend to make the best fighters. They follow orders very quickly. They're very easily trained, and the younger one is, the fewer inhibitions that person has. So commanders know that they can order kids to commit some of those most heinous acts imaginable, and more likely than not, a young soldier or a child soldier will do that, will take that order.
And you've documented this in a number of case studies, one, of course, coming out of Rwanda, Francois.
Yes. I mean, in Rwanda, I spent time with a young boy named Francois, who's 14 years old during the genocide, and he happened to be half Tutsi, half Hutu. And when the Hutu militias came to his village during the killing, he was ordered to kill his nephews with a shovel. Subsequently, he was arrested and tried for his crime and spent 3 years in prison. But his experience was very common. You often saw people within the same family, within the same community, turning on each other, because they were part of the wrong ethnic group.
And now you've not only spent a number of years documenting these cases, but you went back in some cases and explored the aftermath. What did you see? What was the effect on these kids after they were able to get away from this fighting?
Well, I think as a rule, those kids who did receive some form of rehabilitative support fared the best. When kids emerged from conflict and were sent straight home or sent back to their communities, they didn't do as well because they, more often than not, they needed some sort of psychological support, some sort of treatment for the trauma that they endured while in the bush, while fighting. At the same time, these kids at a very young age have been drawn to combat, and during a period of life when most young people in the world are in school or playing sports or personalities and turn into soldiers. And so, you know, without that natural support, without that natural social process occurring, they often fall back into the child soldier mentality.
So we have a continuing cycle of violence that flows from this.
I mean, exactly. We know from, especially from places such as Liberia and Sierra Leone, that kids who don't receive that rehabilitative support tend to either become street kids, criminals, in some cases they become mercenaries of sorts, where they're recruited to join the wars of neighboring nations.
How did you connect with this story?
Well, prior to exploring the issue of child soldiers, I spent a lot of time in the U.S. looking at juvenile violence, whether it was through gangs or drug culture, looking at the impact of poverty and AIDS on the lives of young people, and how all these different forces shape the lives of urban kids as well as rural communities. And in many ways, you know, I was preparing myself to explore this issue without even knowing it, because you know, I think where the context may vary of a young person growing up in East New York or in Chicago or in L.A., I think the impact is very similar. The trauma is very similar, and sometimes the response is similar too. So it was very, you know, it was very natural for me to move from the domestic realm to looking at the issue of violence and youth internationally.
So you see some parallels.
I definitely do, and I think there are lessons to be learned from both situations.
When you said not enough is being done, you mean by authorities to try to handle this problem?
Well, I think it comes down to resources as well. I was telling someone recently that, you know, most countries tend to be good at breaking things but not putting them back together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it, you know, is unfortunately, it's very easy to arm these youth because small arms such as automatic rifles, light assault weapons are very, very available to these youth and to the commanders who use them. I mean, now the weapons are so basic, so simple, so light that the smallest kids can use them. And I think, you know, that is an issue that must be tackled aggressively. But what happens when these kids survive? What happens when they come out of the bush, come out of the jungle, come off the battlefield? I think that's really the hardest part of the equation because, you know, long term, we don't know what the impact will be. And oftentimes, you know, people who join as children come out as adults. So they're not always eligible for certain UN or non-governmental resources.
Is there a role for the United States to play in this regard internationally?
I think the United States has a major role to play because, you know, whether we like it or not, whether we see it immediately or not, increasingly, children are becoming the face of war in places such as Afghanistan and Iraq, where we do have an obvious military presence. Our soldiers, our men and women overseas, are increasingly having to face children on the battlefield, children in the combat arena, and I think, you know, it's a moral quandary for which we have little preparation. It's not something that exists in our popular history, our popular culture, although we do know that there, you know, the use of children as soldiers goes back to the Revolutionary War, the Civil War. It's not unfamiliar to us, but it's just not something we expect to encounter.
Well, clearly we have an interest. What should the United States be doing?
Well, I think the United States has to more aggressively address the illegal traffic of small arms. I think the U.S. as well has to provide greater support, greater resources for those authorities, for those bodies, which are not only rehabilitating child soldiers, but punishing and tracking down those adults who use it as well.
Hmm. What about the role for private citizens? I mean, you've traveled the country. It's amazing to me that ordinarily book promotion is, you know, roughly a couple of months after the book release, and you mentioned that this book came out a few years ago. This has become something of a mission for you. What are you telling people they need to do?
Well, I tell people all the time that, you know, everyone has a voice. And whether or not one chooses to exercise that voice, whether or not one chooses to recognize their empowerment is really their decision. But I, you know, what's amazed me in the years since the book came our young people recognize the tragedy of what's happening to their peers in other places. The violence, the trauma resonates on some level because perhaps they grew up in communities where the shots are a part of life, where people have been wounded, where they've lost relatives, where they had relatives maimed or paralyzed.
And if they haven't experienced it firsthand, they certainly have experienced it through this mediated reality, through entertainment, music videos and such.
Exactly. That's the point. I mean, you know, this is something that's, you know, whether they recognize it or not, it's not that far from their reality.
Hmm.
And so, you know, from what I've seen and what I've heard and, you know, when I've dialogued with young people in this country, they've done some amazing things. One school I visited in the Bronx, they were gathering petitions in their neighborhood, in their borough, to deliver to their state senator in order to push that person to stand up and raise the issue even more in the U.S. Senate on how to better protect children of war. Another school I visited in Minnesota, they were doing talent shows and fundraisers, bake sales, to send money to the Congo for kids who were being assisted by a small organization there. I mean, you know, regardless of where you live in the world, regardless of your experience, there is a role to play.
Well, clearly the work that you're doing is generating a great deal of interest and commitment. We have less than a minute left. What has been the impact on you, on your life, of seeing this firsthand and experiencing it as a journalist and as a person?
It's been extraordinarily transformative, to be honest with you. Since the book has come out for the past 2 years, the book's been out. Prior to that, I spent nearly 7 years doing research, traveling, reporting the book, putting it all together. And so in many ways, this has become a life mission for me. This has become a journalistic focus. And, you know, I just think back to my first time in northern Uganda, which is one of the places I visited for the book. And a Ugandan man said to me that if a dying person tells you his story and you don't pass it on, you'll be haunted. So on a certain level, I feel like I've got to pass on these stories. I have to pass on these experiences and be an advocate for those who are not able, who weren't allowed to stand up and convey the horrors they endure daily.
Well, Jimmy, we certainly appreciate that you've shared it with us.